This is Does Not Compute on the Spec Network, as always. Thanks so much for supporting us by listening to the show and leaving iTunes ratings and reviews. Your support means a lot to us. Sean and I wanted to give a quick shout-out to the other shows on Spec. If you're not listening to them, you are missing out. There's a podcast for every nerd, from designers to developers to people who really love movies and video games. If you're an iOS or a Mac developer, you should also definitely check out Little Bites of Cocoa, one of the Spec family blogs. It's run by Jake Marsh, who's a great developer and very skilled at breaking things down into, well, easily digestible bites. You can find links to all of the Spec content, as well as the Spec Slack, on our website at spec.fm. Boom. I thought that was pretty good.
Yeah, that was good. No, it was good.
I think that's our little snippet. So, I broke down and got an iPad Pro, Sean.
Is it as big as everyone says it is?
It's pretty huge. It feels... So I think it's a 13-inch screen, but it feels bigger than the 13-inch MacBook to me. I guess it's just because you hold it a little bit closer than you generally do a laptop. But I'm liking it a lot so far.
Right. You don't generally hold a laptop in both hands in front of you. You just kind of set it on something.
Yeah. It's like, I guess, probably, what, half the distance or so that you usually would have a laptop?
Yeah.
Something like that. So it feels really massive, which is kind of cool. Surprisingly light, though.
Well, I mean, the input devices that you use are pretty drastically different. I mean, I guess unless you have a touchscreen laptop, you're not trying to hold it in one hand and use it in the other hand.
Yeah, for typing, I found a lot of times I will set it down on a flat surface and just kind of type on it like a normal keyboard. Because the on-screen keyboard is finally about the same size as a normal keyboard. The keys are around the same size. Hmm. So it makes it pretty easy to type on. And basically nobody has the smart keyboards in stock yet, so I haven't been able to try that out.
I see people tweeting about that a lot. I thought it was pretty funny. People were just going on a rampage the day that the Pros came out.
Yeah, I called the Apple store, I called a bunch of them, and finally one of the people I got a hold of actually checked the entire state, and there wasn't a single Apple store in the entire state of California that had an Apple Pencil or a smart keyboard.
That's interesting.
So they're in very, very short supply right now.
What's your favorite thing about it so far?
Well, I think the coolest thing I've done so far is set up Coda to be a completely mobile work environment. So I actually have a development environment with all of my stuff on it. All my repositories synced to it, all of my development environment set up, all my different Ruby versions installed, all that stuff running on DigitalOcean. And it's like a 2 gigabyte box. It's pretty smallish. And then on Coda for iOS, I actually have each site set up as a connection to that development box. So normally when you're working with Coda, for anybody who hasn't used it, what you do is you go in and set up the remote side of each site as your production environment. But instead of doing that, I've actually gone through and set it up as my development environment. So basically what that means is that I can browse the remote file system as if it existed locally on the iPad and then edit files, and they're automatically saved up in my DigitalOcean box. And since Coda also has the built-in terminal, I can just open a new terminal tab and then just, you know, git commit A, whatever. And all of my stuff is committed and I can push it up. I can do deploys from there. I can test... you know, PHP and Ruby apps and Python apps, whatever I need to be testing, I can test it directly on a full-on Unix machine while editing it from pretty much anywhere on the iPad, which is pretty nifty.
Yeah, I guess that's similar to the idea where people set up dev boxes with Vagrant on their machines, and then that way they have a completely isolated environment for whatever app they're working on. I've seen that happening a lot. I tried the DigitalOcean thing for a little bit too, and I was SSHing into the box and using Vim as my editor, which I do sometimes. And it was pretty awesome because when I was doing that, I never had an issue where I got to the office and thought to myself, well, I didn't push, so I have to ride my bike back home. The only thing that was bothering me about it was network latency. So I would be typing and then my input would just stop for a second, and it drove me absolutely crazy.
Sure. So, I mean, you know, I've done a similar thing before with the DigitalOcean SSHing in to use Vim. And I kind of ran into some similar issues. But the really cool thing about doing this with Coda is that Coda actually downloads the file. And then when you're working on it, you're editing it locally. So there's no lag. When you open the file, it downloads it, and then you're editing it. And then when you save it, it actually re-uploads it to the SSH server. So the only time there could ever be any lag is when you're opening or saving, which isn't critical. When you're actually typing keystrokes, it will always be as fast as the local device is.
That's pretty awesome. That makes me kind of want to try it out. I was Googling, I think it was maybe a couple of days ago, and I came across a project called Mosh. I think it was by MIT. And it was a replacement for SSH where they do things like persistent connections and such, so you can actually change networks and you stay connected to the server, which seemed pretty awesome. But I think you had mentioned, Paul, that they didn't really have great support or something.
Well, it's just not on every server. You know, you can SSH to anything, right? It's just kind of one of those things where it's not everywhere yet. Also, is it Mosh or Mosh? Because I know the word Mosh, like a mosh pit, but Mosh would be mobile shell. So maybe it's a play on words. I don't know. I don't know. If anybody who's listening knows that, let us know.
I just went to the site and it says mobile shell, but I guess I just see that and I think Mosh in my head. But that seems like a pretty sweet setup. I think you could probably do something similar too if you're working on the desktop with Transmit Disk, where you connect to it via SSH and then you would edit the files locally essentially. And then when you save it, sends the file across.
Yeah, and I don't think this is something that I would want for an all-the-time setup. Because, you know, you lose some of the conveniences of having a desktop computer, namely the extraordinary customization you get. But, I mean, Coda iOS is pretty great. If you want to make quick edits or even, you know, you want to go on vacation but you don't want to bring a laptop, this seems like it could be a very, very viable setup.
Have you tried connecting a keyboard to it yet?
Unfortunately not. I haven't connected a Bluetooth keyboard to this iPad. I have to other iPads in the past, and that always works, you know, fine. But I'm really looking forward to trying out the smart keyboard once I get my hands on one of those.
Yeah, I might have to pick up an iPad Pro so I can test websites and things on it.
So I can test. It's for work.
It's for work. Work things.
I swear it's for work.
No, it's, I don't know. The whole setup thing has got me really intrigued. The whole kind of, I guess, having your dev stuff on an external server that you can get to from any computer and, you know, it's something that you have automated backups running on. I mean, obviously I back my computer up, but it's so easy on DigitalOcean just to set it and forget it and know that it's running backups and stuff.
I think it's a great middle ground. And just then worst case scenario, let's say you don't have any of your devices, you'll still be able to shell in to that box and make changes as long as you have access to your certificate.
Yeah, that seems pretty nice. And I'm pretty sure I've seen you SSHing into things on your phone before as well.
I definitely have for emergency fixes. I mean, I've deployed code from the top of a mountain before in Yosemite. Like, that flexibility is pretty great. It makes you worry a lot less when you have to be on call for something all the time.
So I'll have to find that picture for the show notes, but that picture of you sitting on a rock with your phone up in the air on literally on top of a mountain in Yosemite was pretty funny. That's dedication, folks.
So the kind of the other thing that I've been using the iPad a lot for is, this sounds goofy, but Twitch and YouTube. And I know we've talked about this a fair amount before. I really like watching people play video games because then that makes me play video games less. And this isn't strictly a development topic, but I think it is kind of interesting because, you know, a bunch of nerds probably like to play video games.
So yesterday I was sitting on the couch and I was getting ready for the week and I really wanted to play Fallout 4 and I knew I didn't have time to. So what I did was I turned on the PS4 live stream and watched somebody else play Fallout while I worked. And I still felt pretty gratified afterwards. Maybe that's a weird thing to say, but I felt like I had just spent that time playing even though I was more productive.
Yeah, I feel like I get a lot of the same brain feelings, I guess endorphins out of it that I do from actually playing the game, which is really kind of surprising to me. You wouldn't think it would be like that, so similar, but it really is, at least for me, and it sounds like for you too. And I think that's kind of neat, because when you're just watching something, I guess it's probably kind of like listening to podcasts, right? People can do that in the background and also be productive while they're experiencing that enjoyment.
So earlier this week, friend of the show, Bill Columbia, was asking us about how we approach learning new things and still getting stuff done at the same time. And I guess one of my secrets is that Twitch thing where I watch people play games instead of play them myself.
That seems like such a goofy thing, but it really does make a big difference, at least for Sean and myself. This is such a complicated thing. There's so many different components that play into how you can learn new things but still get your quote-unquote real work done. Ideally, I think the best case scenario is that there is some sort of CTO kind of role. That is not always the case, but if you have a good CTO, that's going to be someone who can explore new technologies, and it is actually their job to explore new technologies and figure out what direction your team needs to be headed in. And I think a good CTO will make this sort of stuff way easier, because you don't necessarily have to be making these kind of calls as much as a developer. But that is absolutely not always the case. And in fact, I would say the majority of the time that is not the case.
I'm not sure that I've ever worked anywhere where I had someone that made those decisions for me and just kind of handed down, this is what we're using and this is why. It's always been more of an exploratory phase, I guess, in what free time I might have. And I guess one of the points that I came away with after thinking about this was I try to use my most productive or efficient hours of the day to try to learn new or implement new things. And that's mainly because at those times of the day, my brain, you know, I'm able to comprehend things the best. Whereas maybe like right after lunch or something, I tend to use the times like that where I'm kind of tired or worn out to do things that I know really well. So maybe if I'm learning some new JavaScript things, I'll take those times where I'm not able to focus as well and work on things like CSS that I might have a better grasp on.
Well, it makes sense, right? You want to take the time where you're maybe not quite as focused or not quite as aware and alert to just put in the stuff that you already can do. I mean, you can do it in your sleep. That's why that expression exists, right? Because it's something that you can just do no matter what all the time easily. And it makes sense to put that stuff into the time where you are kind of asleep in a way, and then put the learning into really productive times. So that way it sticks with you better and you're able to think through new concepts more clearly.
Right. And that's something that I've done a lot pretty recently, actually. And it seems to work pretty well for me. That way, you know, I'm able to get things done that need to get done. But I'm still, you know, I'm still investing time into learning some new stuff. Another thing that's really helped me here is, before I start in my exploratory phase, I write down a few concrete things that I want to get out of it. So I've wasted a ton of time finding something cool or finding something that I thought was cool and trying to use it, but I didn't really have a clear goal. And so really what I would do is just run in circles there.
I think that's so, so important, because it's really easy as people who are into technology to find something that looks neat and then tinker for hours and hours and hours. I've done that myself so many times, but that's not necessarily productive or helpful in any way. So I love the idea of writing down goals, concrete goals beforehand. I kind of did this when I was researching Vue. I didn't just go in and start using Vue right away and say, oh, this will be fine. It'll go well. That kind of comes back to the cowboy programmer concept that we've discussed before, just doing stuff, you know, shooting from the hip. But what I did with Vue is I said, okay, I'm going to read through all of the documentation for this. And it took me, I think about an entire day. It was 6 or 7 hours. And it was not extraordinarily fun. But by the end, I knew exactly what I really liked and didn't like about that framework. And I think that that's really powerful to have those goals in mind, where you say, okay, I need to know if this tool is the right tool for me. Am I going to just integrate it into my environment? No, I'm going to read what other people have to say about it. And I want to find out points A, B, and C. I need answers to these specific questions. And I think that's a really great way to approach new tools. So that can kind of help you focus down your learning. So you're learning new stuff, but you're being productive about how you learn it.
So I don't know if any of you have listened to a little podcast named Design Details, but they've been talking about this a lot recently. And I really liked this point that they make. And they basically just talk about learning the smallest possible thing that's immediately useful to you in that moment.
Now, I think this is important to break down a little bit, because you might say, okay, well, learn the smallest possible thing. But Paul was just talking about reading all of the Vue documentation. And that seems like a really, really huge chunk of things. And it definitely is. But in that case, my goal wasn't learning how to use Vue, because I already had an idea of it. I'm familiar with Angular and React, and which it's inspired by both of pretty heavily. So I already kind of knew how it worked. What I was interested in that case was the specifics of how Vue implemented different things, because I wanted to see how it differentiated itself. And when I was doing that, the goal was to determine if it made sense for me to use, not for me to figure out how to actually do something. So in that case, I would say that reading the documentation was the smallest possible thing.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it was the smallest possible thing that you could do to make an informed decision.
But that doesn't mean that you need to know the entirety of every single API that you want to use ever, because that would be pretty infeasible. It just means that in that particular case, the easiest way for me to determine whether or not this was a valuable tool for me was to read through the documentation.
That's a really good distinction to make. When you're kind of in an exploratory phase of, should I use this thing? You want to cover the breadth of the thing, right? You don't need to dive deep into the thing to make that informed decision. But once you make that decision that you're going to use this tool, then you start, you know, needing to chip away at whatever you're building. And that's when you can start simplifying things and saying, all right, I'm working on this feature of the app. What do I need to know just to build out this feature?
Absolutely. And when I was reading through the docs, I didn't memorize everything, not even close. I still look up stuff on how to do things in Vue every single time I use it. But I did get a really good overview of how, I guess, what the philosophy is.
And a lot of times I find that by reading all of the docs, I generate little memory fragments. So when I'm working, I'll have a spark of a memory saying, oh, I think there's a thing in the docs about this, or there's a feature for this.
Yeah, you'll go, oh, wait, I know there's a method that lets me handle this just in one line instead of the 10 I just wrote. And you won't have it memorized, but you will know that it's there, which is a huge, huge benefit. I think this is kind of one of the things when you start programming that makes it really difficult, because you don't even know what it's called. Like, you don't even know what an array is at first. You just like, I need a list. I want to make like a grocery list app, and I don't know what I would call that. So you don't even know what to Google. And that's kind of a thing for me, is like, even just knowing the terms that you need to Google to figure something out makes programming infinitely easier. It kind of comes back to the old saying, the hardest thing about programming is naming stuff, right? And I think that's pretty true. And naming stuff can mean when you're writing the name, but also recalling the name, like naming it in your head.
I've always struggled with naming things, and I don't think that's ever going to go away. But really, that's a really big part of learning how to program, like you said, is just learning what things are called. A way that you can get a leg up on that is just to read lots of stuff, like glance over lots of things, you know, and then parts of those maybe names might stick in your head. That's what ends up happening to me, you know, when I'm working with my parents or whatever, I'm teaching programming, they'll ask me something and I'll give them an answer. And they always ask, well, how did you know that? And most of the time I respond, well, I read it somewhere. I don't remember where, but I did.
It was in some newsletter. I don't know. Totally. That's a programmer's life, is like, you know of a concept and then you have to look it up to figure it out, which I think is totally fine. You are human, right? You're not a computer. So you aren't going to remember everything, and just be okay with that. But knowing the terms and knowing what your tools are capable of makes your life so much easier in the long run. So you linked me this pretty sweet article on closures not that long ago. It's by Igor Sarcevich, and it is called Closures Are Not Magic. And this is something that trips up new JavaScript people all the time. Like, what is a closure? And then you ask somebody, hey, what's a closure? And they say, oh, well, you know, it's a thing in JavaScript where the variables and the scope, meh. And you never really get a great answer. But this article does an amazing job of breaking down exactly what a closure is and explaining it in plain English. The long and short of it is that a closure in JavaScript just means that if you define a function, it will always have the variables that are in scope when it's defined in scope. So let's say you have a function that defines another function inside of it. On the outer function, if you have a variable, that variable will always be accessible to the inner function, even if you call that inner function from outside the outer function. Now, that sounds really, really complex, but I promise you this article breaks it down in a very easy to understand way. And when you read through these examples, what I just said, if you go back and listen to it after you read this article, it will totally make sense to you if it didn't already. I think this is awesome. I'm really into articles like this that kind of make intermediate topics more accessible to developers. I think this is so great, taking these things that people have so much trouble understanding and then breaking them down in very, very human ways. I love this article. I think it's amazing. And even if you know what a closure is, you've been programming JavaScript for years, I would really recommend going back and reading through this article, because it kind of really cements in your mind how this part of JavaScript works, which is a very integral part, really, of how scope in JavaScript functions.
So when I think of closures, I think of a refrigerator. And say my roommate Chris, he puts some mac and cheese in a container. The mac and cheese is always going to be in the container. But when he puts, say, his salad in the fridge, it doesn't mess with the mac and cheese at all, and the mac and cheese doesn't mess with the salad. Or if he puts like an onion in a fridge that is not covered up, my mac and cheese is not suddenly going to taste like onions in a couple of days.
Did you just come up with that?
Yeah, like 2 minutes ago.
Oh, that's pretty good. That's pretty good. I like it. He puts a salad in the fridge.
It keeps the global scope of the fridge smells clean.
Sure.
That's what a closure does. Think of your application as a refrigerator.
So I think this is a fantastic article, and seriously, everybody go read it right now. It does such a good job explaining this concept.
Another incredibly useful resource for people that are just kind of getting into JavaScript development would be this article by Robot Lolita called How Do Promises Work? And I know personally I had a really tough time getting my head around promises, and this article really helped me out. It basically breaks down the different steps of promises, like how they're set up, and also it breaks down different use cases, like promise and error handling and combining different promises and such, in a really practical way, including illustrations that help obviously illustrate those points. But yeah, like I said, I had a really tough time learning how to use them. Recently, I was working on a Node application, and that was my first kind of dive into Node. And I was in a situation where I was using the Adobe Generator framework, and all of their functions return promises, so they all run asynchronously. And I was having a loop that was running that was just spinning off all these functions. What ended up happening was it was running so many of them at once, it just overloaded the server and it just crashed.
I feel like promises are kind of interesting because they started off as a little bit of an esoteric kind of thing where you didn't always need them and only kind of more advanced JavaScript code used them. But now promises are everywhere. They're in every library, every framework. They're in everything all the time. And the reason is because they're super useful. They're even a jQuery in the basic implementation of their AJAX function. They just exist all the time, everywhere. And so having an understanding of them, I feel like that's something that's becoming more and more important. And this article, again, just does such a great job of explaining this topic that can be a little bit intimidating in a very, very accessible way. Like Sean mentioned, that it has a bunch of illustrations and very simple, not word problems, but word explanations, I guess, of how this stuff works. And it makes it very, very clear exactly what's happening when you create a promise or when you use a promise. I think that's really cool. This article does such a good job. This author goes by the name of Quill, and she has a bunch of other fantastic articles on her website. It breaks down a lot of complex stuff, kind of in the same way that this promise article does. But for more things on promises, there's also an article or two on monads and explaining how JavaScript prototypes work, all that kind of stuff, all the programming things you've never quite understood, but understood enough to get by, you finally have awesome explanations for these. Seriously, check out Robot Lolita or Quill. She has some really, really cool articles on her site that do a great job of breaking this stuff down so that everybody can understand it.
And to bring it back around, after I read this article and thought about it for a little while, I ended up being able to solve the problem that I had created where I was just calling so many functions at once. I ended up using the Q library that it's just a different implementation of promises for JavaScript. But what I ended up doing was I created an array, and then each time the function was called, it just returned a deferred promise. And for every iteration of the loop, it adds that promise to the array. And then after directly after the loop, I used the Q.all function. And what that does is it takes the array that you created as an argument, and it watches to see when all of those promises have been resolved. And when all of those promises have been resolved, it runs a callback that you specify. That allowed me to do rate limiting for that function, so that way it would only be called X number of times per second. And then I could reliably wait for them all to be done before I continued on to the next step.
So I think that's kind of another reason why promises are so important, is because so many people are solving their problem, but they're not using promises or anything. They're just going into callback hell. And if you right now are stuck in callback hell, you should absolutely, even more than everybody else, should already check this out. You should 100% check this article out, because it will explain to you how promises work and how they can help you get out of callback hell, which is awesome. It makes your code so much more readable, and it makes your life so much easier, and you will never, never, never regret it.